Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about the Youth Media Project. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program John Stauffer. He is chair of the History of American Civilization Department and professor of English at Harvard University. He's the author of many books, the most recent one of which is Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. And he will be in Santa Fe giving a talk this Friday, the 18th of March at 7 o'clock, titled Slavery and the Meaning of America. It's at the Forum on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be on the air with you.
So the book Giants, which I am just reading now and which is just fascinating, demonstrates a number of parallels in the lives of Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass, and it brings out, I think, many of the myths of America. One is the story of the self-made man. In the case of these two men, both of whom rose from pretty violent circumstances through ambition and education, and I have to say, not the ambition for wealth, how did each one do it, and what drove them?
They did it for a number of reasons. I would say the most important factor that accounts for their rise is young boys, both Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln, understood the power of words as the most important weapon and tool in their lives. And so long before they ever met, when they were essentially barely teenagers, they virtually memorized the same six books or authors, including the Bible, Shakespeare, Lord Byron, and both understood that to be an effective writer, and especially public speaker. This was an age in which public speaking was one of the only forms of entertainment. It was analogous to being a professional athlete or a movie star today. If you could speak well, you could draw people from hundreds of miles away, and there were a few limits to how far they rose up. And so despite their very violent backgrounds and the fact that neither had any formal education, Lincoln had less than a year, Douglass had none as a slave, by becoming among the most eloquent public speakers and the most powerful writers, that was the single greatest factor. There are other factors as well. Both were blessed with being very big and strong men. Lincoln was 6'4 in his bare feet, as he liked to brag, and Douglass was almost 6'2 and very muscular, and the average height of men at the time was under 5'7. So they, especially Lincoln, they towered over other men. And ironically, at the very time in which they were defining themselves as budding intellectuals, they entered into a pretty vicious fight with an opponent in their communities, and both of them called their fight the turning point in their young lives. And both had a fight when they were, Lincoln was 21, Douglass was 16. And it gave Douglass the confidence to make every effort to become free and to conceptualize freedom, not just for himself, but for everyone. And Lincoln's fight with the leader in New Salem, Illinois, that he had, in the wake of the fight, Lincoln first began to think of himself as a leader in his community. Another factor was that both men married up, and the women in their lives were instrumental to their success. Douglass married a free woman, Anna Murray, who had never been a slave, and it was really her money that allowed him to take the train north to freedom, and her money that allowed him to acquire the equivalent of a passport to pass as a free black. And Lincoln, when he married Mary Todd, he very much married up, and too many Lincoln biographers who romanticize Lincoln dismiss Mary Todd Lincoln as a kind of mad woman in the attic, and she was more savvy about politics than Lincoln was at the time. I mean, Mary Todd grew up next to Henry Clay, who was Lincoln's hero. They met because of their shared passion in Whig politics, and they started dating when they both championed the 1840 Whig candidate, Harrison. And so those are all the factors that contributed to their rise up, but the most important was the fact that both were among the greatest writers and public speakers in American history.
Talk more about the culture of violence in the United States. Master-slave violence was a given, and Frederick Douglass certainly had his share of that, but there was also a great deal of violence among white people and even toward animals, as you describe. Why so much violence? What was going on? And in the face of this supposedly Christian nation at the same time?
Right, that's a great question. Largely because the United States was still a slave nation, in the sense that in the Revolution, there was not an acre of land that was free from slavery, and then when Cotton becomes king, the South becomes one of the largest and most profitable slave societies left in the Western Hemisphere. And one of the definitions of slavery that Frederick Douglass and every ex-slave understood is that slavery is defined as a state of war. It's a state of war between master and slave. And violence is the very bolt around which slavery depends. And so without violence or the threat of violence, slavery can never exist. And if that's the case, and given that the United States as a nation had been and its origins a slave nation, and then as the northern states emancipate slaves, the U.S. South becomes such an important slave society. In a society that that defines itself around slavery, that depends so heavily on slavery, and given that slavery is so violent, it becomes a culture of violence. And so where you see the rich divergence between a state like Massachusetts, which is one of the first states to free slaves, or Vermont, which is Vermont Constitution, was the first constitution in history that abolishes slavery, to the slave states is the degree of violence. Duels and these rough and tumbles were still extremely popular in southern communities. So Natchez, for instance, Natchez, Mississippi, in the 1840s and through until the Civil War, was the wealthiest city in the country. There were more millionaires in Natchez, which is a tiny population, under 10,000, than there were in New York City, because it was the wealthiest cotton-producing region, and the wealthy planters lived in Natchez. And if you read the diaries of people in Natchez and the letters of people of Natchez, there are these brutal, vicious fights almost on a daily basis, in ways that would have just shocked Bostonians. Duels were legal in most southern states until the Civil War, in ways that most northern states had abolished dueling as barbaric. And that difference reflects the degree to which every slave society, from classical and ancient Greece and Rome, which were slave societies, they were also cultures of violence. And much as in warfare, even in among the civilian population, there tends to be more violence. So I think that's one of the ways to understand the violence in America. It's a byproduct, so to speak, of slave societies.
It's notable, as you mentioned, that both Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln got where they were because early on they established their dominance simply as fighters. Frederick Douglass was able to overpower his slave master at a certain point, who, after that fight, which you mentioned before, the slave owner never hit him again, which is amazing. In the context of that, I was thinking about what that means, first of all, to our nation today, and to the very possibility of at that time suffrage, and at this time women's leadership emerging in a culture where fighting was sort of the way of expressing leadership?
I think that's another great question. I mean, that it's no coincidence that the women's rights movement, feminism, emerges within the context of abolitionism. The first feminists were also abolitionists. Frederick Douglass, in my view, was the foremost male feminist of his day. He was the greatest champion of women's rights of any man. He attended the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848, the world's first women's rights convention, and it's no coincidence that he was also an abolitionist. Women understood the barbarism of violence in ways that men did not, and abolitionists also understood the degree to which slavery was based on violence. So the understanding of what of the costs of violence essentially is one of the things that unites men and women in their quest to achieve universal freedom, and women in a very profound way, in legal ways, did not have the kind of freedom that men have, and also to champion equality before the law for all people. That they both were very sensitive to the degree to which violence can corrupt and create these profound hierarchies.
We're talking to historian John Stauffer. When Frederick Douglass escaped to his freedom in the North, he found rampant racism, although he was a free man. For example, he was offered a job, only to see the entire white workforce threaten to quit if he were to get that job. And this kind of story was common. What was the mentality of the people in the North that held that kind of activity in place? And how do you think it has changed and not changed since then?
That's a great question, too. The vast majority of white Northerners were extremely racist. They were racist for a number of reasons. One is they felt that the presence of blacks were a threat to their vision and their understanding of a democratic nation. They believed that democracy was should be defined only for white men. Many Northern whites also felt that abolitionists like Frederick Douglass, they were a tiny minority, or William Lloyd Garrison. The abolitionist community was the first truly integrated community, and most Northern whites saw them as a threat to the nation because they felt that they alienated Southerners and it could divide the nation, and so they hated white. They hated blacks for that reason. On an economic, from an economic perspective, a large percentage of Northern working class whites felt threatened by free blacks for reasons that they felt that that blacks might take their jobs or they didn't want to have to compete with blacks. They also felt that if blacks were given or accorded the same rights, then they might be out of work. And they also defined, many working class whites defined themselves as slaves. They said they were wage slaves, that they couldn't understand why people were focusing on slavery in the South, on black slavery, and they said they were more oppressed than black slaves. It was part of their effort not to have to compete with whites. And it was bolstered by the most prominent scientists. Louis Agassiz, for example, who was one of the most esteemed scientists of his day. There's still, to this day, a building at Harvard named after him. He was a Harvard scientist. He argued that blacks were a separate species, that people of African descent were not wholly human, and that that they were innately incapable of participating in democracy. And so from that kind of scientific racism, it helped to justify enslavement. Many scientists argued that blacks' capacity for reason and innate intelligence was such that they should be treated like other domesticated animals. And so the racism fueled both slavery and fueled the white supremacy in the North. I mean, even someone like Abraham Lincoln, who's the head of the Republican Party, and you could say that Lincoln was representative. And when Lincoln, it wasn't until well into the Civil War, really 1863, that Lincoln could begin, and I would say Lincoln is representative, the most white Northerners, even Republicans, could begin to imagine a democratic nation in which blacks and whites both lived as citizens and participated in democratic government. For most of his life, Lincoln said he hated slavery as much as any abolitionist, and there's little reason to doubt that. But his solution to the problem of slavery was something that outraged Frederick Douglass. His solution was that slavery should end very gradually over a long period of time. In fact, in Lincoln's debate with Stephen Douglas, he said the ultimate extinction of slavery, a term he used quite a bit, the ultimate extinction of slavery would occur in not less than 100 years. So in 1858, Lincoln's ideal vision for when slavery would end in the United States would be 1958. Lincoln also called for compensating masters for their loss of their so-called property, which isn't exactly being sympathetic to blacks. And the thing that most outraged Frederick Douglass is that Lincoln felt that freed slaves should be colonized, should be shipped outside of the United States, sent back to Africa. So in a sense, Lincoln and most Republicans who believe slavery to be an evil wanted or envisioned the United States as a lily white nation. And it was only because of the war, and specifically because Lincoln came to understand that in order, and most white Republicans and people fighting in the North, fighting to preserve the Union, they came to understand that in order to win the war and preserve the Union, they needed blacks on their side. There's no way they could win the war. There's no way the North could win the war without the aid and the support of blacks. So in effect, winning the war and preserving the Union became inseparable from ending slavery. And given the fact that by the end of the war, most whites understood that they could not have won the war without the support and the aid of blacks, that they recognized that they then needed to treat them as citizens and give them certain rights.
Reading your book, I find myself wondering if one of the legacies of slavery is not only racial prejudice, but the kind of nationalism that says that the only real Americans are white Americans. What's your take on that, particularly regarding contemporary politics?
Yeah, so, and to go back to the earlier question, the contemporary politics is, on the one hand, it's very different, because in Lincoln and Douglass's day, white supremacy was championed by many people. It was socially totally acceptable to be a racist or a white supremacist. People invoked the term white supremacy, and that was seen as a mainstream, morally, for many people, it was a morally righteous thing to say, white supremacy. And that was true well into the 20th century. And the problem in analyzing American society today is that it's socially unacceptable to say that you're racist, to say that you champion white supremacy, and yet racism is still absolutely, in my view, endemic in American society. And that's reflected in the degree to which America is still profoundly segregated. How many communities do blacks and whites live together? How many schools are truly integrated? Very few. But unlike in an earlier period, virtually no white is going to say, yeah, I'm a racist. I believe in white supremacy. And so in terms of you can't rely on the language or the words of the people in the way that you used to be able to. And so they manifest the racism in more hidden ways, shall we say, or in ways that aren't reflected in their rhetoric. And so at times you still see whites feeling threatened economically by blacks. At times, particularly on the fringe right, you still see you still have a number of right-wing bloggers. In particular, there's one that had a political cartoon of Obama raping the Statue of Liberty, the Goddess of Liberty, which plays into these, you know, long-standing racist assumptions about if you give black men freedom and the rights of citizens, they'll rape white women, which was basically a justification for the culture of lynching that existed from the end of the Civil War until the Civil Rights era. But most mainstream Americans will no longer say that they believe that the United States should be a white person's country. Recently, you've seen a number of fears at the projections of the census. If I remember correctly, according to the demographers, within 50 years, whites in the United States will be a minority. And that prediction horrifies a lot of people. I think you see it manifested in some of the solutions to immigration today, which is the majority of immigrants in the United States are not white, and that greatly bothers people. In much the same way that it did when immigration in the turn of the century was primarily of Southern and Eastern Europe at the time, when Italians and Jews came to the United States, they were seen as a separate race. So the very concept of race has changed. I mean, most people don't see Jews or Italians or as separate races today. They did in 1900 and 1910.
So when you talk about that, it's so clear that certainly during the 19th century, it was virtually impossible, despite the fact that Karl Marx was there in Europe writing, doing all sorts of writings that were available to Americans. It was impossible to have a real solidarity between white wage slaves and black slaves.
That's correct.
And, I mean, how did that evolve since then? Do we have that understanding? I mean, I'm sort of looking at Wisconsin and thinking about this whole union busting, and it goes far beyond Wisconsin, mentality. Have people been able to see through when they're fighting for just basic labor rights, the racial prejudices?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the history of the labor movement in the United States has highlighted the problem of race. The AFL for years and years excluded blacks. In fact, the Wobblies, the IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, which were essentially destroyed by the Wilson administration after he arrested the top leaders on trumped-up charges. The IWW was the first labor organization that welcomed blacks. The early socialist movement really did not make much, welcome blacks, as reflected by African Americans. Du Bois, you know, W.B. Du Bois, the African American leader, called the socialists and other labor unions on their failure to accept blacks as equals. It was only really into the 20th century when labor unions started accepting blacks as equals. And one of the manifestations of the issue of labor today is that many former white unionists have fled to the Republican Party and have and explicitly fear the competition from African Americans. So you see, I think the labor movement is a great way to see the tensions between race and class, and the efforts to reconcile them. African American leaders, from Frederick Douglass through Martin Luther King and Barack Obama. I mean, I think Barack Obama's race speech in Philadelphia was one of the greatest political speeches in the 20th century. In that, Obama, discussed. I mean, he began by discussing his relationship with Jeremiah Wright and why Wright would be so upset. But his race speech ultimately was a speech about class. It was a speech about how poor whites and poor blacks needed to unite and come together as a way to fight the power elite, so to speak. And it was the way in which he developed that speech was, in my view, truly brilliant. So you see examples of that throughout American history, but that's been the true test of one's egalitarianism, so to speak, is to what degree have Americans been able to treat different races, people of a different race or ethnicity, and especially race, and of the races, especially African Americans and Native Americans, as fully equal. That's been the Achilles heel in American culture and society.
John Stauffer is chair of the History of American Civilization Department and professor of English at Harvard University. He will be speaking this Friday, the 18th of March, here in Santa Fe, in a lecture titled Slavery and the Meaning of America. It's at 7 o'clock at the Forum on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Sure, thanks. Thank you very much.
I'm delighted now to welcome to KSFR Judy Goldberg. She's founder and executive director of the Youth Media Project, Monique Lacoste, who's the director of education and programming, and Miles Tokono, who is an AmeriCorps Vista volunteer and production coordinator for Youth Media Project, which produces Audio Revolution, a program that airs from 7 to 8 on alternate Wednesdays, alternating with the City Council, on KSFR. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
So we are talking today on the occasion of, well, this Friday from 7 to 11 at the Santa Fe Complex. The Audio Revolution is having a big showcase, which we'll talk about in a moment. But first, Judy, tell us about the Youth Media Project. You are the brains and heart behind this whole thing. How and when did it start?
Well, it's always hard for me to track exactly when it started because it really is a progression of work that I've done over my whole professional life. And I think in some ways the germ of it started when I started doing educational curriculum work up in Peñasco with the Museum of New Mexico, and we started a curriculum called Drawing from the Well, which was all about pulling up the stories from a community, having students go out into the community to get those stories, and then having those turn into radio pieces and short radio documentaries. So Youth Media Project essentially started in 2004, I believe, when I had been an adjunct faculty member at the Santa Fe Community College, and at that time I approached Media Arts Department, Ann Farrell, saying, how about doing a radio show, or a radio class, excuse me, the radio show came later, how about doing a radio class that is about narrative radio? And Mary Charlotte, you may remember well that you were one of our guest teachers.
That's true. I did teach for a very short time.
Exactly.
And still remember our brilliant students that we had.
Exactly. And one of our brilliant students is really our model student of Youth Media Project, and is why I believe we have Youth Media Project today, who is Carmen Gallegos, who started as a freshman. And I tell Carmen's story.
And who I've known since she was 7.
Oh, as Pamela.
she's amazing.
She is totally amazing. And I believe is really why we have seen the growth and success that we have, because Carmen's story is one of an immigrant student who came to this country, who had the opportunity to step into a classroom that we were teaching and realized that her interest was not only in terms of music, which many students have an interest in playing music, but it was in telling her story. And her questioning of who am I, or quién soy, which was the first radio piece she did, really has taken her into Youth Media Project, becoming its own organization, I have to say, and having a radio show, as well as her her own trajectory of doing work, being introduced to social justice work, having come back and worked with us as an AmeriCorps Vista volunteer for the summer. And then we were invited to go to Connecticut, where she went for the first time to the East Coast, and then on out through that work, covering the Global Youth Leadership Institute's program and going on to the Amistad, the Freedom Schooner, and then being us being asked to go to the Parliament of the World's Religions, which was in the December of 2009, which was in Australia.
So Carmen, you've got young people going all over the
that
world.
That is totally the hope of what Youth Media Project can offer students. And when we get on to programming, and Monique will be talking about what we do with schools and colleges and nonprofits and advocacy groups, it's really an entry point. Youth Media Project really is all about education. It's a way of teaching. It's a way of learning. It's a way for students who may not gravitate to, it's hard to imagine, taking tests and writing reports. It's a way to demonstrate learning. It's a way to engage in your learning. And here we are in a state that has more than 50% of students dropping out of high school. And I hate to think that equates to dropping out of the excitement of learning. And maybe for some it does. So at any rate, that's what Youth Media Project is. It's really an intersection. And the beauty of having the broadcasting capacity woven into our work, it makes learning ever more so relevant.
How do you find all the students who get involved in this?
Well, through various means. We do a lot of recruitment in the schools, which Miles has been actively engaged with this year. We go into classrooms, particularly media-related classrooms, and we encourage students to come and work with us. We also find students and go to them in our different partner organizations, such as United World College and New Mexico School for the Arts, for example, as two. And so we'll actually take our services to them as well. So it's really, there's two different ways. We bring them into the production team through active recruitment, and then we go work with them in our partner organizations as well and collect their stories and then use them in our shows.
To what extent are they coming up with their own material, and what kind of material, what kind of stories are they telling?
Well, it's all them. They come up with the themes in the beginning of each season, as well as all of the pieces that they create for the show.
They really come up with all the material. What we do is we give them lesson plans or activities or encouragement in developing their ideas. We really see ourselves as more there to facilitate the development of their ideas, to push them and prod them when necessary and steer them in different directions and give them feedback. But the generation of the ideas and the structure of the shows is all them.
Do you have certain radio programs that serve kind of as models of how you structure a piece, things like that?
Yes, because there have been now five seasons. I believe this is our fifth season of being on the radio. So there are many models, and certainly anyone interested could go to our website, which has many of our shows posted, and that's at youthmediaproject.org.
But I mean, outside of what you have generated, you know, other kinds of work that people have done beforehand, whether it be This American Life or something else.
I mean, I think we do. We definitely do. But we also encourage them to think more broadly about storytelling, not just to find ways to tell stories that are within traditional or dominant media. As much as you can see, NPR is a dominant form of media. But we also encourage them to look to things like poetry, music, personal narratives, other kinds of storytelling. So we try not to confine it just to sort of things that have been done. But we also want them to recognize that those things do exist and find ways that their ideas and their ways of telling stories can link up with what's happening in professional media.
So this is all, I mean, they start going through the process, and next thing you know, they're on the air. Mm-hmm. What happens when the work that you get is really raw? I mean, do you just air it anyway, or do you send them back to the drawing board?
What do you mean by raw?
Yes.
Like, it's just really bad.
Well, we're working with them throughout the process, throughout the writing process, the recording process, as well as editing. And so we don't really have many just raw pieces because we're there with them the entire time, kind of, once again, facilitating, pushing them towards really fleshing out what they're trying to say or trying to produce.
How did you get involved with this, Miles?
Like you said, I'm an AmeriCorps VISTA volunteer for Youth Media Project, and I got involved, kind of crazy story. I was driving across the country, and it just so happened to be that Judy's good friend is a good friend of mine as well. We have a mutual friend, and that the week that I was here in Santa Fe driving across the country was the week that Judy was hiring for this position. And I think I've fit into this job because of my background studying music, which is audio design, mostly, as well as anthropology and autoethnography. So.
What's autoethnography?
Well, Monique can...
You want me to explain autoethnography?
Yeah, you know autoethnography just as well as I do.
Okay.
I was just talking. So.
It's a particular critical method within anthropology whereby the self is used as the site of analysis. So you look to yourself and your experience. It's almost like autobiography, but with a critical anthropological lens to where you use yourself as the place to generate ideas and link up with theories about the world. So a lot of poetry, a lot of storytelling about the self, and that's really one thing that Miles really brings in a strong way, is that ethnographic method as a way for the students to also look at their own work and their lives and how they relate.
And I want to just piggyback on that, that I think that's one of our most successful entry points in doing this work, is that when students can identify their own story, something that they really are feeling compelled by, and then making that link in terms of a larger context that story resides within, that's really pretty much been the crux of our work. And so that we talk about the personal as political, or we talk about how we choose themes, and we hear people's own stories, students' own stories, but we also hear it within what's going on in the world, or what are some of the social issues. And I think That's the hope for this, is that we are brought together by the individual stories, that there is a commonality found in our stories.
Should we listen to a little piece right now?
That would be great. This is a piece that came out of our summer intensive. It's called Family Tree, composed by Andres Ortiz from Espanola Valley High School.
Here we go.
It doesn't matter who you are. You need to know who you are. If you don't know who you are, how can you be who you are? If I don't know who I am, I cannot be whatever I may be. My past is my future, and the present is my now. My past is so important. My past is my now. How do I identify the human I've become? I think about my family and the past they've overcome. I think about the food they made and the music singing strong. I ingrain their faces in my heart, for soon they might be gone. Gone, gone forever, forever to be remembered.
And that was Family Tree by Andres Ortiz. We're talking to Judy Goldberg, Monique Lacoste, and Miles Tocano about the Youth Media Project and the audio revolution. Monique, now how did you get into all of this work?
Well, my background is in media literacy, media studies and education, and social justice. So I got involved in this actual job, and it's similar to Miles' story. It was kind of a synchronous, strange story that seems to only happen in Santa Fe. I had been living in Seattle, going to the University of Washington, finishing my PhD program, and I was looking for work, and I had a dream that I was living in New Mexico. So
you dreamed it?
I dreamed it. I literally went to sleep on a Friday night. I had a dream that I was living here. And I'd only been here once before for a conference to Albuquerque, not to Santa Fe. And so I woke up the next morning and I thought, Santa Fe, New Mexico. Okay. And I looked at jobs on Craigslist and applied for this. And I think got the job 4 days later. Something like that. And then moved down here. And so it's been a whirlwind. And what really appeals to me about the job is that it really allows me to combine these different aspects of my life and my passion, which is, as I said, education, media literacy, and social justice. For me, the work we do is really a social justice effort. It's really about helping young people recognize that their voices are powerful. As Judy mentioned, the personal is political aspect of what we do is we're really invested in helping them understand that the little parts of their lives aren't just about their lives. It's about how they fit into the larger world as citizens and as human beings. And so I think it's very common and very easy for all of us, not just young people, to feel that we have no voice and that the media and culture, it exists separate of us. And what we're really interested in doing is teaching them that that's just not true.
And that our problems are unique in the world as opposed to the exact same problems everybody else has.
Exactly. And so we see what we do as a real effort to help them recognize that that's not true, that everything they experience, there's others who experience it, and to get those voices out there, to see their stories told when their stories are not told in the mass media, their stories are completely overlooked or horribly misrepresented, is powerful. It's empowering, and it's about giving meaning and dignity to their lives.
So you're working with teachers and students and all kinds of institutions all over the place, Santa Fe, New Mexico?
Yeah, Santa Fe and Northern New Mexico is our general scope. Yeah, we work with organizations all over. And my specific position involves doing both overseeing the programming and working with Miles, and also overseeing our educational efforts, going and working with teachers, helping instructors develop curriculum in their schools, working with classes that exist.
Curriculum meaning radio-related stuff?
Right, and storytelling. Really focusing on storytelling and focusing on storytelling for this venue so that different stories can be heard. You know, just in our recent show, we had a story about a Japanese student at the United World College who does rugby. And so just to be able to tell those stories is something you don't hear at all, I think, is really empowering, and it's great for the community to hear those stories. And so that's what we do, and we work with educators as well as with youth.
Now, you've got a summer intensive coming up. What happens? You had one last summer. How do people find out more about it, and what do you actually do in the summer?
Well, we're actually having a little departure from how we've done it the last 3 years, which has been a summer intensive specifically for young people and also as a means to potentially recruit them for our production team in the school year. So the summer intensive has been focused on training the skills of digital storytelling and teaching them how to record and how to edit and how to develop stories. This summer, we are really reaching out to the adult population who are interested in doing this work with youth. So it's really the youth practitioners in the community who see the value of learning these skills. So that is really the point of what's the class is called HUDV 270 Service Leadership, and that can be you can sign up for
at
that
the community college?
At the Santa Fe Community College. Similarly, we're seeing about doing a youth focused summer intensive as well, which would follow the pattern of what we've done the last 3 years. So this is really we see great potential in it, and I think having been myself very much a learner of hands on. And applied learning out in the big world, that to me just seems, as we go forward, just the power of this work and the possibility for students.
Do you see people going into media careers and college majors and things like that?
That is absolutely a big part of our goal. We don't want the learning to just stop with the production team or me or Miles coming into their classroom. We want them to go on and see this as a viable career option for them to get the skills. You know, we don't just train them to tell stories. For the kids we work with most with, we also train them to do editing. We train them to engineer. We take them into the studio. We really see it as a providing a way for them to have a career and options. And as we know, in New Mexico, that's really vital to have that as a career option. So we see ourselves as fulfilling quite a few roles, and that's definitely one of them.
And I think parallel to that is that communication skills can be applied anywhere. And because we are now part of something at the community college called the Office for Community Learning and Service, that these are real leadership skills as well. And we've been told by students who've worked with us, it's like, you know, not such a big deal to stand up in front of a classroom or to stand up in front of groups and talk. It's such a confidence-building experience that it can be, it's transferable to whatever profession.
So the Audio Revolution Showcase is happening this coming Friday, the 18th of March, from 7 to 11. That's a long program at Santa Fe Complex. What's actually happening?
Miles.
Go for it, Monique.
Well, the showcase is an opportunity for us to introduce the community to the great work being done by all of our different partners that you see featured regularly on Audio Revolution broadcasts. So we're having performers doing everything from hip-hop and poetry and monologues and flute performances and dance performances from all over Santa Fe and northern New Mexico. We've got kids from United World College, Monte del Sol, New Mexico School for the Arts, bunch of different organizations that we've got students who are going to be doing this performance. We've also, following that, we'll have live music performances from local bands, including Tree Motel, Fallen Few, Hannah and the Handbones, and Guadalupe Parrish Vargas, who's a local hip-hop. I'm sure you know him. So that's really what it is. It's also an opportunity for people in the community who have been doing this work to meet each other, to get to know us, to get to know what the, just, I think, amazingly talented young people in this community are doing. I'm just constantly blown away by their talent, and that's what the hope is, that people who come to the event will be as well. We're also having a raffle and food. It's going to be a great time.
And also video projections, and one of the great things at the Santa Fe Complex is they have, what, four or five different projection systems that we're going to be accessing, so it will be a live happening. Plus, if for some reason you can't make it down there, it will be streamed live on, and you can find it at youthmediaproject.org/live.
Very nice. Now, do you have, this is a multimedia event, obviously, in the Youth Media Project, in Audio Revolution, is there a visual component to it at all on your website or anything?
Yeah, we've been working to expand Youth Media Project's media side as opposed to just doing radio and oral stories. We've been moving into doing audio slideshows with students and teaching them how to do not necessarily just audio editing, but also video production editing as well.
And so some of the fruits of that will be seen on Friday night.
Absolutely, absolutely.
What are some of the topics that people are actually engaging in the Youth Media Project in Audio Revolution?
The topics are all over the map. Everything from, we had a show on what is American identity, where the students discussed everything from what it means to have free speech to white privilege. We've had a show recently on suicide, youth suicide. We have a show coming up on called Young and Out on sexual identity in the schools and for young people. Shows on unconventional art. What is art? Asking those kinds of questions. So they really engage in topics all over the map of culture, politics, capitalism. I mean, we see all of these things coming up in almost every show, really.
And a current project that we're working on with Adelante, the Santa Fe Public Schools Student Wellness Program, as well as with Real Fathers, and the focus is Fathers in Focus, so working with students to create their own stories around fathers.
Now, there are listening parties, so not only can you listen on the radio, you can actually listen in a group setting. There's one here at the Santa Fe Baking Company, I think, on Wednesday, the 6th of April?
Absolutely. So accompanying our show, we have these things called listening parties, which is kind of what we think is part of the empowerment of our work, that kids being able to listen to their pieces live with a group, getting feedback, is really an exciting process for them. And we've heard some really great testimonials saying that they never knew how powerful their voice was until kind of these listening parties and hearing their voice on radio live.
And of course, on radio, you never really know who's listening, so it's a way to kind of get around that. Youth Media Project is on the web at youthmediaproject.org. Judy Goldberg is founder and executive director. Monique Lacoste and Miles Tokuno are with the Youth Media Project and Audio Revolution once again every couple of Wednesdays on KSFR when there's not a city council meeting from 7 to 8. And we will see you at Santa Fe Complex this coming Friday, the 18th of March, from 7 to 11. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.